Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. A recent report published by the California Attorney General Kamala Harris reveals that over the past decade, black men have been killed by police in California at 8 times the rate of other residents. Nationally, black men are 7 times more likely than white men to die by police gunfire while unarmed. The shooting death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, ignited mass protests, gave birth to the Black Lives Matter movement, and shined a light on police violence, racial inequality, and racial profiling. And then in April, Baltimore became the latest city to explode in popular protests over the death of Freddie Gray, a young African-American who died while in police custody. In his new book, The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America, today's guest, teacher and writer Dee Watkins, writes, quote, "As innocent black men and women are killed on a regular basis, newspapers should print daily death counts with photos and casualties, like they do during wartime, because for black America, this is war," end quote. Dee Watkins knows firsthand what it's like to live in a segregated America. He grew up in East Baltimore and spent years witnessing the deaths of his friends and family. When he was just 14, he wrote a 20-page paper for his history class called My Baltimore, The 15 Times I Was Almost Murdered. When he was 18, he was a full-time crack, heroin, and cocaine dealer, and then he discovered writing. And here he is. He's a professor at Coppin State University and runs a creative writing workshop at the Baltimore Free School. He's also a columnist for Salon and author of the new book, The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America. And Dee Watkins joins me in studio. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having me. I'm so honored to be here.
Well, I'm honored to have you. I loved your book. I feel like I know so much about you. And what an amazing journey you've been on. I mean, what really struck me is this paper you wrote in history class when you were just 14, a 20-page paper, which most 14-year-olds do not write 20-page papers, called My Baltimore, The 15 Times I Was Almost Murdered.
Yeah, my history teacher, Mr. Brown, I was transferring to a school called Dunbar, where I ended up graduating from, and the only history class that was available was an honors class for 11th graders, and they put me in there, and I was challenged with that task. He gave us, you know, the assignment, which was 20 pages, whatever we wanted to write. And those are the stories I wanted to tell. I would kill to find that paper right now. Like, I just want to know what the writing was like so bad.
I bet. Well, so talk about that paper, because you write about how throughout your life, luckily, you didn't get hit by a bullet. So you'd be at a party, for example.
I actually did get hit before, but just a flesh wound. It took a little meat off. And it's not an uncommon thing. You know, we have all these conversations about guns and the black community and drug culture and things like that. But we have to acknowledge that gun culture is American culture. Andrew Jackson used to bang it out on the White House lawn. Alexander Hamilton murdered Aaron Burr, who was Thomas Jefferson's vice president. You know, so gun culture is American culture. And I'm anti-gun. We need to get rid of them. You know, police officers in different countries that don't even carry guns.
Right. We've done shows about that.
You know, we need to get rid of them.
You write that growing up in East Baltimore, it was easier for you to get a gun than it was to get a job.
Still, in Baltimore is a place where a black person with some college and no jail record has less of a chance of getting a job than a white felon. So it's still easier to get a gun than it is to get a job. And we have to be vocal about these things. We have to talk about them on radio, television. We have to write about them. We have to let people know. We have to expose these systems because, you know, they're keeping people down. And Americans who are smart and talented and work hard just aren't getting a fair shake.
Let's talk a little bit about what it was like to grow up on the black side of Baltimore. You have so many incredible stories about the black side of Baltimore and the white side, which isn't that far apart, but feels like two different worlds.
Footsteps apart, and it's two different worlds. And, you know, the races, they almost never mix. There's a few places that are popping up now that the art community is in control of. And this is what I love about art so much, is it forces our worlds to merge. That's just the redemptive power of art in general. But still, Baltimore remains to be very, very, very segregated. You know, when I go out with my black friends, it's a whole different experience than going out with my white friends. It's like everything from the dress code in the nightclub to the price of the drinks to security to, you know, the time they break parties up, everything's different.
A lot of us know Baltimore because we watch The Wire. And so, and there's so much writing about The Wire and how people in Baltimore think about that. But how did your experience growing up on the black side of Baltimore shape your thinking of just race and economics in general?
Well, you know, I never really thought my experience was different until I started to explore those different worlds. That's, you know, so something that I would think would be normal as a kid wasn't normal when I had more experiences with other cultures and places outside of my neighborhood. So it shaped me in a lot of ways. First, you know, the first step was anger. And then, you know, when I realized why some of the things happen the way they do, that anger turned into me appreciating the beauty of what I come from. Like, I love my neighborhood. I love the people in it. And I love how resilient it made me. Growing up in East Baltimore, it makes it pretty easy for me to get through the art world. Like, I can take criticism. I can take rejection. I can take you not really feeling me. You know, a bad day isn't you saying my painting or my essay is trash. A bad day is a gun in your mouth. Seriously, so I can take some rejection.
Well, and I'd love to talk to you about, you know, when you found reading and writing and decided that writing was your weapon of choice. But talk first about your childhood and what it was like for you to grow up in East Baltimore and how that's different from kids who are growing up there today, if at all.
It's not really too different. You know, I mean, I grew up in a time before social media. So there wasn't little kids walking around fingering phones all day, but we did everything that kids do everywhere. You know, we played basketball, we played football, we ate ice cream, we sat out all night and wanted to be like the older dudes. It was a beautiful place, minus drugs and the murder. There was a strong community. You know, a lot of times people from the outside looking in don't really understand the social fabric that exists within communities. Like, you know, it's like, so for example, a gentrifier would say that a person who doesn't own a home or a neighborhood full of housing projects is a place that doesn't have social fabric. And it's just not true. Our social fabric was so strong. There were so many people doing so many positive things. And I, you know, despite some of the tragic things that happened, I think I had a pretty amazing childhood. My brother was in the street. He worked really, really hard to keep me out of the street. One of the things he always did was he always told me the bad things that came with being a street guy, selling drugs and things like that. And when I was a kid, I didn't want to sell drugs. It was the last thing in the world I wanted to do. Selling drugs when I was coming up was like an 18-hour-a-day job. And it's so much responsibility. Like, my friends who started selling drugs when they were like 9 and 10 and 11 and 12 years old, they had, you know, they had to hit quotas. They had to be outside 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. They had to worry about, you know, messing up packs and people running off and people trying to take advantage of them because they're children. So it was so much responsibility. And I was more like, yo, we're going to ride dirt bikes today. Like, today, like, we're going to ride dirt bikes. Like, you know, you want to ride dirt bikes? Oh, I got to wait. So I got to wait 5 hours for you to finish your shift before you can actually come and ride with us. And that was something that I didn't want to be a part of. Plus, my brother had money, so it wasn't like a money issue. I could just, you know, if I wanted something, I could just ask him for it and he would buy it.
You also write about the pain involved in drug dealing that doesn't get that much attention, because obviously dealing drugs, you're putting your life on the line. And so many of the moms who have lost their kids and the aunties who've lost their kids and nieces and nephews over drug dealing and people who are in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah, I take big issue with the glorification of it. Like, America romanticizes the hustler, the criminal, the gangster, right? It's, you know, it's so romantic, you know, Joe Kennedy story, right? We look at these things and you know, Goodfellas and things like that, and that's all fine and good. You know, people can romanticize whatever they want to, but I feel like it's my job as a person who lived that life, it's my job to talk about everything that comes with it. I can't just stop at, oh, yeah, I did have a house in Bolton Hill, which was, you know, and it still is an exclusive neighborhood in Baltimore. I did have a CL 600 Mercedes-Benz when I was like 22 years old. I did buy my girlfriend a Lexus SC430 when she graduated college. I've done all of these things, but at the same time, a lot of other things went down too. There's shootouts, there's losses, there's stress, there's friends dying. There's, you know, my best friend has 27 years in prison right now. I was just talking to his uncle yesterday about different things I can use my platform as a writer to do to get him out of jail, because he's, you know, his life is gone because of nonviolent crimes. You know, so it's like, all of these other things come with it. And as society, not just rappers, but movies and television and everything, we don't do a good enough job telling the whole story. Mm-hmm. And I just, like, I took that responsibility on, and then I challenged other people to do it too. Now, I don't tell artists what they should create, but I do challenge people who make money off of these stories to tell the whole truth.
What's the response you get when you do challenge them?
I don't really get a lot of kickback because the people who know me locally, you know, they don't really play with me like that. Like, I have respect, you know, I respect them and they respect me, so I can talk to them and I can pull them up on that stuff and we can have good conversations and they can, you know, because one guy actually who was kind of out there, we kind of got into an argument about it, and it was a great argument because he said, look, man, check this out. If I want to talk about these things the way I want to talk about them, I should be able to, because if I was a fiction writer, you wouldn't have a problem. If I was making movies, you wouldn't have a problem. So why, as a hip-hop artist, do I have to, you know, follow these set of rules? And we had an exchange back and forth, and I definitely understood where he came from, and I learned some things for that conversation too, even though I feel how I feel.
Now, before you started dealing drugs full-time when you were about 18, and mm-hmm. before that, you went to Loyola University?
Yeah.
So you've got some amazing stories about what it was like to be a black person from a low-income housing project going to Loyola, and you write that you're a philosophy teacher. A tweed coat named Dr. Rose or Dr. Ross was the worst. You said one time he asked, quote, what sport did you play to get in here?
Yeah.
And that was just a common occurrence, right? This is just sort of subtle racism, everyday racism that you face.
Subtle racism when I didn't even know what subtle racism was, you know, but I was going through it every day. Yeah, I didn't last there that long. I was only there for maybe like a month tops, month and a half. I didn't last that long.
And is it because of the social environment and what you had to deal with?
And, you know, it wasn't just their fault. It was my fault, too. I didn't really understand how to communicate with them. Mm. So it's difficult for me to charge them with not being able to understand me if I'm not putting forth that effort and trying to understand them as well. So if I was a better communicator back then and I had a better understanding of how this world worked, then I would have been able to stick it out. I was also, you know, a first generation college student. So, you know, I didn't really have anyone around me to give me those skills and that knowledge and what I really needed to advance and even try to make it in that world.
Talk more about that, because you write about how you had no problem breaking a Hennessy bottle across the back of some guy's head because you had so much rage, and that was attributed to your inability to communicate. And you say that it's identical to the rage that burns in the poorest parts of cities across the country.
I was talking to a guy not too long ago, and he had a rough day. He was going through a really, really, really tough situation. And as he was telling me the story, He just kept saying, you know what I'm saying? You know, something. Now I mean, you know what I'm saying? And I'm, you know, I was like, I know exactly what you're saying, but you can't communicate. You can't say it. And part of your frustration comes from that too. And I think, I honestly believe that if an officer like Michael Brown, I mean, if an officer like Darren Wilson could effectively communicate with Michael Brown and vice versa, then Michael Brown would be in college right now. I believe that. I think a lot of these situations go down to fear, a failure to really understand a person's culture, and then these cops react. So, you know, a kid like Michael Brown he's stressed out because he's not being treated fairly by these police officers, and then a police officer is stressed out because he's terrified of a person who's harmless. You know, Michael Brown didn't have a gun. He didn't deserve to die. If they could just talk it out, or if they could communicate, or if they could understand each other's realities, then the situation would have probably ended in a different way. I really believe that, and I have to believe that because, you know, it's the fuel that I use to drive forward. Like, I believe communication will solve a lot of these problems.
I'm speaking with D. Watkins about his new book, The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America. He writes, telling our stories and educating people are the best things we can do if we hope to pull ourselves out of this bloody mess. When he was 14, D. wrote a 20-page paper for history class called My Baltimore, The 15 Times I Was Almost Murdered. When he was 18, he was a full-time crack heroin and coke dealer, and then he discovered writing, and now he has a master's in education from Johns Hopkins and an MFA in creative writing from the University of Baltimore. He teaches writing at Coppin State University in Baltimore, and he will be appearing at the First Congregational Church in Oakland tonight at 7:30 and tomorrow at Green Apple Books on the Park in San Francisco, also at 7:30, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts, if you've got experiences like Dee, what is it like to move back and forth between a predominantly black world and a predominantly white world? And what are your thoughts on the kind of experiences that transforms people's thinking about what we're currently dealing with, about police violence, about race, about inequality? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You mentioned that you had a house in Bolton Hill. So that's a nice part of Baltimore?
Really nice. It kind of looks like those brownstones that the Cosby family used to live in.
And so after this
stuff, I was like Theo's age when I got it. You know?
So when you were dealing drugs, you were able to live in Bolton Hill, and you've got this incredible story about how you would invite your friends over, and you know, smoke, drink, whatever, at 2 or 3 in the morning, and you'd leave all like a full trash bag out on the street in front of your house.
Yeah, and you know, it's crazy because that small amount of time at Loyola is how I discovered that neighborhood. One of my friends, a white guy who was kind of from that neighborhood, and he was also from a neighborhood called Roland Park. His parents owned some property in Bolton Hill, is actually how I got introduced to that neighborhood. And I was amazed by it. And the way that came about was I think somebody was doing some construction. It was the first time I saw it, and they left some trash by the house next door, and it was gone the next day. And then one day I was just, you know, I just wanted to see what would happen, because even that neighborhood inside of Baltimore City had its own little police department, its own group of guys patrolling that was outside of the Baltimore City Police Department. So it's a super exclusive neighborhood. Television people live there, politicians, judges, and people like that. And then there's also like a lot of art students there, too, because there's an art school right next to where Bolton Hill is, Micah University.
So what happened when you left the trash outside?
It was gone. It was gone the next day. I came outside the next morning, like early in the morning, and it was gone.
And then you did the same thing with a big bag of trash in the black neighborhood closest to Bolton Hill, which is called Marble Hill.
And the same, and it was, and it's probably still there. This is over 10 years ago. It's probably still sitting there. It's over 10 years ago, and it's probably still sitting there.
Well, you know, we've done shows about this, about how there was white flight in the 60s and 70s, and before white flight happened, all of the services would be perfect. The lights worked, the trash would be picked up, and then after white flight, the trash stopped being picked up, and now we call them the projects.
Yeah, it's real. It's extremely real, and I think that one of the things that I can do personally is, again, promote literacy, promote reading, promote this whole idea of why it is important to tell your own story. And that's how, even with white flight, we can take control of these neighborhoods and we can create the infrastructure needed to change some of these issues.
When did you first realize that writing was really powerful, and that's what you really wanted to dedicate your life to in order to change what we're currently facing?
So when I became a reader, one of the main things that I noticed was the stories of the people who come from neighborhoods like where I come from weren't really being, in a contemporary way, they wasn't being done right. They were done by people who had no idea. Not all of them, but a lot of them were done by people who had no idea of where I come from and the people from my neighborhood and people who come from neighborhoods like mine. It was almost like an elite, and I'm talking on the white side and the black side too, elite people were coming in and they were writing their little stories, and it just wasn't really representing the people. And you know, that almost challenged me to do something about it. So you know, I didn't take this challenge lightly. I took my time and learned the craft. I became even more of a reader, and I enrolled in an MFA program, and I worked really, really hard at it.
Well, and now you're a columnist for Salon. You've been published in the New York Times, The Guardian, and other publications. Your new book is The Beast Side. You don't mince words when you write about what you faced, police violence, about race. Did you get any pushback from editors about just being so brutally honest about this?
I get pushback all the time. It's happened. And, you know, sometimes I'm able to get away with some things and some things are extracted. But, you know, I don't let how I feel as an artist or how I feel as a person block my overall mission. You know, I look at myself as a servant. I work for the people. It's my job to tell these stories. It's my job to take on cops. It's my job to take on institutional racism, systemic racism, and the many disparities that our communities face. So I have to put my own ego aside to make sure that the story gets out there, because that's my job. That's what I'm supposed to do. That's what I'm here for.
And it's interesting because you think about the audience, right, that you're writing for in, say, a Salon or the New York Times.
Yeah, a lot of them don't really have a clue, you know. But on the flip side, so many high school students who enjoy some of my Salon essays and who are loving the B-side are being introduced to these places through me telling their stories, my story, our story. Mm. So it's like, you know, it's a win-win. It's like there's a whole new demographic being created.
How are you getting the stories into high schools?
So I was teaching at a school called Friendship, and when I was telling them I was a writer, I was sharing my essays, and they just started sharing them on Facebook. And then every time I was dropping a new essay, they were just popping up like all over Facebook and all over Twitter and places like that. And I developed like a small following locally in my city, to the point now where there's so many high schools in Baltimore that teach my essays, and there's so many high schools in Baltimore that, like, they have like these little things up hanging up on the wall, like, you know, D. Watkins reading challenge and things like that. And I'm honored that I'm just a part of the solution, you know, like I'm doing my part to be a part of the solution. Other authors like there's a guy named Wes Moore who wrote this book, The Other Wes Moore, that was really big. He'd go in schools to talk, and he'd see pictures of me and my essays on the board, and he would text me like, yeah, man, this is, you know, you know, you're doing great work. And, you know, I'm honored by those students and by people who are also taking on these challenges and working really hard at them.
You also worked over the summer with the Inner Harbor Project, which partners with teenagers in social change endeavors. You're currently working on a mentoring project with Baltimore high school students.
I have 3 students right now, but I just found out that I'm about to get 10 more because I'm going to partner with that school, MICA, that's right next to Bolton Hill, and they're developing like a whole community outreach, a community outreach portion of their school where they're going to have artists living in East Baltimore and working with residents. And they reached out to me right off top. They're getting a grant together right now so we can pay students to be young journalists. You know, we're going to pay them to document stories and talk about what's going on in their neighborhoods from their own perspective, which is so important. I'm so happy. I'm excited about it. The first project we're working on is going to be a website where we just go around and collect narratives from Baltimore residents. So many Baltimore residents are being pushed out of the city. There's like 80,000 displaced people right now, 15,000 families. So what our website is going to do is it's going to be a place for anybody who wants to know about Baltimore history from actual Baltimore residents from like, you know, the 50s and the 60s, the 70s, 80s, early 2000s or whatever, they'll be able to come to our site. And it's going to be a great tool for preserving history. I think it's going to be a great project. I'm kind of trying to model it after the Federal Writers Project, where we collect all of these personal narratives.
D. Watkins is my guest today. He's out with a new book, The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America. He writes that telling our stories and educating people are the best things we can do if we hope to pull ourselves out of this bloody mess. D. will be appearing tonight at the First Congregational Church in Oakland at 7:30 and tomorrow at Green Apple Books on the Park in San Francisco, also at 7:30. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco. To join in today's conversation, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We can always, we love to hear from new voices. And if you prefer to write rather than call, the email address is feedback@yourcallradio.com. .org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, World Have Your Say, and then at noon today, John Perry and Ken Taylor and Philosophy Talk.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about how climate change is fueling larger and more frequent wildfires. As of last week, more than 5,000 fires were raging across California. That is 1,500 more than last year at this time. So how is the drought intensified by global warming fanning the flames? That is tomorrow. And then Wednesday, we'll have a conversation with Dr. Damon Tweedy, author of Black Man in a White Coat. As a black man, he writes about what it is like to be a surgeon, and also what are the disparities, racial disparities in our healthcare system. That's on Thursday. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, I am joined by Dee Watkins, professor at Coppin State University. He runs a creative writing workshop at the Baltimore Free School. His new book is The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America. He grew up in East Baltimore. When he was just 14, he wrote a 20-page paper for his history class called My Baltimore, The 15 Times I Was Almost Murdered. By 18, he was a full-time drug dealer, and then he discovered writing. And he'll be appearing at the First Congregational Church in Oakland tonight at 7:30, tomorrow at Green Apple Books on the Park in San Francisco. That's in the Inner Sunset, also at 7:30. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. There's so many more young people, I feel like, are finally getting a voice in the media. We're hearing from people about their own experiences. So talk about how that maybe changes your opinion about the issues that we're dealing with. What kind of experience transforms people's thinking about all of these issues? And then what is it like to move back and forth between a predominantly black world and a predominantly white world? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from John in Oakland. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. Yes, I'm enjoying this show. Given your guest is from Baltimore, it seems to me I remember years ago the mayor of Baltimore was calling for a radical change in drug policy, mm-hmm. and I tend to agree with that because it seems like as long as we're trying to make some progress in the shadow of prohibition and drug war policy, it's just, you know, two steps forward, one step back. And I would really love to know what Dee's opinion is of, you know, a radical change in drug policy, one that would reflect more of a European model of harm reduction.
Yeah, I'm a huge critic of the war on drugs. I think it's a total blunder, a joke, like a dark spot in history. And we need to change it. We need to reform it. We need to just end it, you know, and there's so many people who are just sitting in prison, you know, their whole lives for nonviolent crimes. And I think his name was Kurt Smoke, and he was radical, and he had some amazing ideas, but the machine stopped him. And when I say the machine, I talk about the people who are making money off these kids going to jail for drugs, for committing nonviolent crimes. The people who are making money off of the people who get sick from using the drugs, right? The people in healthcare. There's so many people making money off the war on drugs who don't even see people who look like me as a person, so they don't really feel bad about what they're doing, and they're not coming up off of that. So, you know, that's a conversation that we need to have, and it's, you know, it's sad. It's extremely sad.
Well, and so you're still in touch with your community, and what do you hear from, and you work with so many young people, what do you hear from young people about why they turn to dealing drugs?
So, you know, I say this stat a lot because, you know, it helps people really, really, really understand Baltimore. 97% of people in Baltimore who are born in poverty die in poverty. It's extremely hard to get a job as a black person in Baltimore.
You can 97%.
Be 97% of the people in Baltimore. And this came from the Long Shadow. A guy by the name of Carl Alexander conducted a 35-year study with 400 poor white families and 400 poor black families, and surprisingly found that you have a much better life as a poor white person than as a poor black person. And it's extremely hard to make it. It's almost impossible. You can do the right thing. There's so many people who never thought about selling drugs or being involved in any criminal activity who migrated towards it out of a sense of survival.
Also, where Freddie Gray lived in the Sandtown Winchester neighborhood, mm-hmm. One half of the residents are unemployed. One third of the homes are vacant. 60% of residents have less than a high school diploma. And the crime rate is among the highest in Baltimore. The same goes for the neighborhoods and housing projects on the east side of the city.
And these people want to work. Like, they want to work.
Right.
But the opportunity's not there. They want to work. Like, they really, really, really want to work. The schools are putting out students without the skills needed to be able to advance in certain ways, on top of the fact of the opportunity just not being there. People want to work. I know a guy who was a parent of a student I was working with last year. He used to walk like 10 miles to work every day because the bus didn't run. Public transportation is so public transportation can actually keep you out of the workforce. Racism can keep you out of the workforce. All of these different things are keeping you from being able to work, but people want to work. It's just the jobs aren't there.
Well, and also, if you're a young person and you're surrounded by garbage that's not being picked up, by streetlights that don't work, by dilapidated buildings, and then also you describe, you write about your 13-year-old nephew, is it Butta?
Yeah,
Butta. And how he was getting in trouble in school, and you wanted to intervene to see how to resolve the issue. So one day you went to the school with your sister to talk to the substitute teacher, and you wrote that the school basically looks like a jail. You say the stairwell smelled like used rubbers and rat pee, blunt guts, unidentifiable fluids, and candy wrappers laced on the floor. You said you stepped over that to get to the office. Butta's floor looked like the psych ward. Students bolting up and down the highways, desks taking flight, a trail of graded and ungraded papers scattered everywhere, fight videos being recorded on cell phones. I mean, so this is what a 13-year-old walks into every day.
You know, I used to be the person who used to say, you know, save the schools, save the schools, save the schools. Now, I'm more like, okay, let me talk to the students. You're going to get a classroom with 30-some classmates. You're not going to have any technology. You're not going to have a motivated teacher. If you get a motivated teacher, you're lucky. Use them as a resource and extract all of the positive energy from them so that you can have that. And figure out a way you can navigate to the finish line. Figure out what education is to you, what a win is, and then aggressively attack that so that you can be successful, because the schools aren't there to help you. You know, school's supposed to be responsible for 20% and then your home life 80%. A lot of people in Baltimore think schools do 100%, where in actuality they're doing about 5 to 7%. So you're responsible for getting the rest of that. So I try to think about, you know, because there's people who try to reform systems all of the time. And, you know, I love their work and I appreciate their commitment. But I'm more on, you know, let's just look at school like a video game. How do you get from level 1 to level 6 to level 10? How do you do this while taking something away that you can use for life?
How do the kids react when you talk like that?
They love it. They love it. They love it because I talk
reality
to them. I don't play with them.
Right.
I don't sell them, you know, the dreams of social mobility. I tell them, look, yeah, you can benefit from the American dream. You can make something out of your life, but you have to be a strategic planner. How do you develop those skills to be a strategic planner? Pick up a book. Doesn't have to be my book. You know, I would like if it was my book, but it doesn't have to be my book. Pick up a book. You should be reading something every day, because you'll never, ever, ever develop the skills needed for you to advance if you're not reading. And then I asked them, why do you think it was illegal for slaves to read? The consequence of a slave reading was death. Why do you think that? Slave owners didn't want their slaves developing these complex skills and these thoughts and these ideas and just being able to have the skills needed to get off of the plantation, to start their own farms, to have insurrections and things like that. So it's the same thing. If you keep people dumb, you can control them and put them exactly where you want them to be, inside of the prison machine, which is like the number one employer in our nation.
How did you do it? Because, again, you went to Johns Hopkins, you dropped out after a month, you became a full-time drug dealer, and then you decided to go back to school and you went to the University of Baltimore.
Yeah, I went to Hopkins actually after I went to the University of Baltimore. I started out at Loyola.
Loyola, right.
Yeah, so I think that one of the things that helped me is I've always been a curious person. Like, I could never take, you know, this is the way it is. I always needed to know why. And that curiosity led me to taking some of that street money and using it to travel, or using it to try to frequent different places and understanding different perspectives and things like that. I think that curiosity saved me. I was just riding around with a reporter from the Baltimore Sun the other day, and And we were having fun. She said she wanted to get some quotes from the article. So we just rode through East Baltimore, and I was just yelling out the window at people that I knew. And they was just walking up to the car and telling her about me growing up as a kid. And one of the common things a lot of them said was, you know, he doesn't really like to take no for an answer, and he just always has questions for questions and then questions for his questions. So I think that was one of the things that sparked my interest. And sparking that interest led to exposure. And then when I was exposed to different things, it allowed me to see that you don't have to make money in the street. You can make money doing anything if you're good at it. Mm. You just have to have the skill set to do it and the work ethic.
Dee Watkins is author of The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America. Dee will be appearing at the First Congregational Church in Oakland tonight at 7:30, and then tomorrow at Green Apple Books on the Park in San Francisco, and the Inner Sunset also at 7:30. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from George in San Francisco. Hi, George. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Brother Man, we've been hearing you. We wanted to ask you a question. Stop and imagine a moment. Who are these people? These are dreamers and the critics and edge workers in the street who do not submit, are gunned down for resistance or for eye-to-eye contact or a provocative smile. Those are our dreamers. Mm-hmm. What happens to us without those people in the mix? They're being eliminated? Are they being eliminated systematically? And is there a campaign within police agencies or other agencies which conceal racism, where some of the bad apples are concealed by some of the good apples? When it comes out, the police is telling you, you had your chance. You got your black president. Now go back. It's over. Is this what's going down this year?
You know, one thing that people don't really understand is that having a black president doesn't mean racism is over. Just like if Hillary Clinton won, we wouldn't have to abandon the need for a feminist agenda. You know, it doesn't work like that. In Baltimore, We have a black mayor, we have a black police commissioner, we have a bunch of black cops. Some of the cops who actually hurt Freddie Gray were black. The problem is these are all people, black people, who are operating in a racist system, meaning that those same black cops who helped run Freddie Gray down and broke his neck would not have done that to a white kid, would not have done that in an affluent neighborhood. It wouldn't happen because they're still on the same slave-catching agenda from 200 years ago. And that's the problem. We can't firing those cops doesn't change systemic racism. Electing a black president doesn't change institutional racism. It's how we attack these systems and the different methods we use to break through. I think we need more people like yourself who understand how these things work to infiltrate these systems and be that voice inside, you know, because we have to hit these things from every section.
Well, thank you for calling in. We did a series on police violence and race. What are your thoughts about where we are right now? There's a couple different things happening. I mean, you've got now a place like California is releasing statistics for the very first time. I read that in the intro. A new report found that black men have been killed by police in California at 8 times the rate of other residents. Okay, so now it's official. And then you've got conversations happening across the country about injustice, about racism, changing the culture. There's just so much unconscious racism. What are your thoughts about the conversation that's happening at the national level?
It's old. No one should be surprised. We know this.
Yeah.
You know, you can hide stats or you can put stats out. Or you can, you know, you can try to, you know, we can do these things to try to solve some of these issues, but we already know what it is. So it's like, what's the next step? You know, what are we going to do and how are we going to work together to fix these issues? You know, no one should be killed. Like, no one should be killed. And it goes back to some of the things that we were talking about earlier about just gun violence and our nation's history in general. And then some of these police agendas, like, it's just, it's a mess.
You write about just the issues that you've had with police officers, where you getting pulled over is just a regular part of your life. You were going into your own garage and you got slammed on the ground. I mean, we're hearing these stories now on a regular basis.
Yes, it's crazy. It's crazy. And the cops who did that, they didn't even apologize. They didn't even apologize. It was almost like they felt entitled to my freedom, to my time. They felt entitled to that. And that's why I said there's a serious problem in these departments. And if you fire them, they're training up 300 more just like them to take their place, who are bonded to the same culture.
What are your thoughts on, I mean, where do you see this going? I mean, how do you think this is going to change? Because of video, for example, we are seeing so many things that have been happening for decades, but we just haven't seen the video.
Yeah, and video doesn't work, as we saw with Eric Garner. You know, I mean, you know, thankfully it worked for Walter Scott, but Eric Garner, I mean, an illegal chokehold on video, a man crying for his life, telling the officers he couldn't breathe, you know, and then the nation is fascinated with this whole movement against bullying. Is that not bullying? 5 cops walking up on you and choking you out? Is that not the definition of bullying with the illegal chokehold? You know, at what point, if it's 5 cops, he has no weapon, it's 5 of you guys, at what point were you scared for your life? At what point did you think he was going to kill you? At what point, like, did you, he squoze his neck until he died. He literally squeezed the life out of him over loose cigarettes. Eric Garner probably would love to have a job. Systemic racism can stop that. Nobody wants to sell loose cigarettes. Mm-hmm. That's crazy. Nobody wants to make a living selling loose cigarettes. And people who sell loose cigarettes, it's not even a threat. Who are you hurting? Smokers going to smoke anyway. If cigarettes in New York didn't cost $1 million a pack, they wouldn't have to buy loose cigarettes off the street anyway. So all of these issues, people just trying to survive. That man was just trying to survive. He was just trying to get from Monday to Tuesday, and he lost his life for nothing. Some guy's ego. Some bully's ego.
Dee Watkins is the author of The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We have an email from Kate who says, what is the obligation of non-African-American writers to write about race? Writing about race is in an ordinary way about everyday experiences seems to elude some writers, or they just ignore it because it's not their issue.
If you want it to be your issue, then it can be your issue. If you feel like you want to talk about some of these things, even expose your own vulnerabilities and put yourself out there, you know? If you're one of these people who generalize, talk about it. If you're one of these people who can explain these ideas to an audience that I could never reach, talk to them. You know, we're together in this thing. It's not just, you know, this is a war that if you love America, you should be a part of this war. You should take it on because, you know, we all share this country together. Our contributions to this country are extremely important. So we deserve to get anything that anybody else could get here, you know, because we built America. You know, America is not a superpower because of advancements in technology or the Industrial Revolution. America is a superpower because of free labor. So, you know, if you care, you can definitely join this war, and you can share your own story and the things that you learn from your experiences and interactions and use them as a tool to enlighten people who aren't brave enough to jump in.
What about creating alliances with other groups? Native Lives Matter, for example, a lot of people feel like they're having a hard time getting media attention. I heard a sociologist on KPFA recently, his name escapes me, he was talking about class issues and how if you took every black man out of prison today, the prisons would still be full with white poor men who mostly don't have high school degrees. And he said, what I would love is the next time a young poor white man is killed, I'd love for Black Lives Matter to link arms with that family.
They did.
And then you'd see this movement.
They did it for Zachary Hammond. He was a 19-year-old white kid that got killed over a bag of weed. You know, All Lives Matter didn't show up. Black Lives Matter was the first place that started actually promoting and talking about that case. So I think, you know, again, I think that, and this is for me, I can only speak for myself when I talk about these things. I'm into doing the work. If I get media attention, cool. You know, more resources, more people trying to build with me, whatever. But I'm into the work. I don't care about the news. I don't care about trophies. I'm not validated by, you know, I won a couple of writing awards and plaques and little stuff, whatever, this year. And it's cool. It feels good. As an artist, it's cute. Like, you know, you get a little trophy, like, it's cool. But I'm into the work. Like, it's all about the work. Media attention is cool. People who talk and hang out with politicians, all that stuff is, if you know, whatever. I don't deal in stats, and I don't deal with politics, and that's not my... I deal with people. You know, I always tell this story about how I was talking to someone I know running for office not too long ago, and, you know, he was telling me something about 37% less people in his district are being hit by cops, and I'm saying that's still a lot of people bleeding, and getting hit by a cop hurts. Like, those clubs hurt. One person is one too many, especially if that person didn't do nothing. So I focus on the work. Like, I try to have an impact on the people that I can directly build with and attach myself to and share my resources and my skills with. And that's the mission for me. All of that other stuff is like, you know, because, you know, people sit around and they critique movements all day long. You know, it's so many experts on, you know, I've been an activist for 50 years. Look what I've done. Nothing. Look where we at. Look, cut the news on. You know, are you bragging? Are you really bragging about this? Like, if I'm active for 50 years and I'm looking at everything's the same as it was when I was 15 and 20 and 30 years old, I'm going to be sad. I'm going to be depressed, or I'm going to keep pushing until I'm in the ground. I'm not going to sit around and brag, I got 50 years of activism under my belt. You know, I got t-shirts. I got, you know, come on, man. Like, cut it out.
Well, thank you for the email, Kate. Let's go to our next caller, Cornell in Santa Cruz. Hi, Cornell. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, it's Colonel Terry.
Hi, Colonel.
And,
Terry.
We've talked before, Rose. Look, my bona fides are, my father integrated a manufacturing plant in Oklahoma he managed, and when he offered equal employment opportunity in 1954, before there was any law, just out of morality and ethics, to the black population that was 40% of this mid-sized city in Oklahoma, I was called son of the N-lover and suffered all kinds of abuse at the all-white grade school I was attending. Now that's... And in the Air Force, I was the only white person invited to two of three weddings sergeants working for me had one summer. And also, I spent part of a summer in the late 60s helping to recruit voters in Alabama, which my parents were not happy about. Those are my bona fides. And lastly, in Washington, D.C.,
we're almost out of time. We're almost out of time. Can you please get to your question?
If I could help.
Excuse me. Sorry, we're almost out of time, and I want to make sure that Dee has time to respond to your question.
Let me respond. Let me come to the bottom line. I observed, sadly, we have teenage women, black or white, having children they cannot care for or nurture. They do not even feed properly. And then we have children who are unsocial, who have all the handicaps that obviously cause high crime rates and so forth. And my question to your guest is, I am disappointed I don't hear leadership in the black community demanding of the black community that it also responsibly conduct itself, that it declare the drug pushers are not going to be allowed in their neighborhoods, and most importantly, as Mayor Stokes of Baltimore said years ago, we can correct all these problems in Baltimore.
All right, thank you. I have to cut you off because we're almost out of time. Dee, your response?
My response is, I dedicate my life into doing something that schools didn't do for me, and that's teaching thinkers and encouraging people to think. If you think, then you're not going to be dealing drugs. You're not going to be having kids that you can't take care of. You're not going to be making poor decisions. You're going to be thinking, and you're going to be living a life towards productivity and doing positive things. But thank you for your energy and your passion and your commitment.
Well, and we talked about this earlier, but what happens when you go to a school that smells like rat pee and has so much sticky, gross stuff on the ground that you have to step over it to get to your next classroom?
Honestly, for me, one of the powers or one of the things that has worked for me since I was a little kid was just, like, I've always acknowledged problems. So you got guy A might be sitting over here saying, man, these cops are racist. These teachers are racist. They don't understand me. This school's crap. Like, man, we ain't going to be nothing. Where I would sit next to him and say, okay, I get it. These cops don't like me. I understand. These teachers don't know what they're doing or what they're talking about. This school's a mess. I get it. Now, how do I navigate through this? How do I get to the piece of cheese at the end of the maze? Mm. And that's been my thing. You give me a crappy situation, and the challenge for me, I'm in the challenges. So the challenge is, how can I get to the desired result? That's been my thing, and I don't think it's exclusive to me, but I think if you're in a, like when I was in the street and everybody was on the corners and on the blocks and things like that, you know, it's a game that you can't win. I acknowledge that. How do you get around that? It's the same thing in college. It's the same thing. It's in life. You have to acknowledge the obstacles if you want to beat them. You can't just be upset and angry at them. You have to say, yo, this is the hand I'm dealt. I'm just going to put on that poker face and play it like a champ.
Hmm. Do you have a quick story of a student that you've worked with who's now channeling some of that anger, that energy into writing or some other form of art?
I had a student named Noah who he had an 8 because he had a behavioral problem. And through still photography and video is how he found his voice. He didn't know what he wanted to do. He knew he didn't want to be in school. And he's about to graduate from high school right now. He's actually one of the kids working on this project with me. And he's, since he discovered art, he's just become a transformed person. He's even in his mannerisms, he's more calm. He talks in a more calm way. He sees the world differently through the lens of his camera. And, you know, it almost he did it the same thing that reading has done for and writing has done for me is what photography has done for him. And I'm so proud of him. And even in Baltimore, he's still challenged. Someone put a gun on him and took his camera. Mm. So like now, you know, but I'm lucky that I have resources now. So I'm going to use the organization who I just partnered with to get him a better one.
D. Watkins is author of The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America. He'll be appearing at the First Congregational Church in Oakland tonight and tomorrow at Green Apple Books on the Park in San Francisco at 7:30. Both events are at 7:30. D., thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. How is climate change fueling larger and more frequent wildfires? On the next Your Call, we'll discuss the increasing number of wildfires blazing across California. Because of climate change, fire season is now 78 days longer than it was in 1970, according to the U.S. Forest Service. As of last week, more than 5,000 fires were raging across the state. That's 1,500 more than last year at this time. So how is the drought intensified by global warming fanning the flames? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.